Welcome back, Ramble Nation, to another episode of The Living Numbers Podcast, where we lead struggling professionals from a place of current doubt to a place of future clarity through inspirational stories using numbers. This week, we counted up with Dr. Hajar Yazdia. She's a professor at USC, a published author, and an agent for social change here in the United States of America. She sums up our episode with these three things. Number one, question everything, question everyone. This philosophy, passed down from her parents, made her the person that she is today. Number two, the culture gap is getting wider and what we can do to turn it around. And number three, how and why MLK, the great Dr. Martin Luther King, how his words were used to reverse affirmative action. That's going to be explosive. Of course, we close it out with our three what's, which you don't want to miss. Thank you all for listening. And now, cue the intro. The Immigration Act of 1882, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with, levied a per-person tax on people entering the country, among other things. But your parents are immigrants, and you credit them for your free-thinking mindset to change the world on their macro level. I definitely had to write that question down, but it's something I wanted to kind of pin down because their background influenced you in a great way. So the question here is, what are some of the lessons that they taught you growing up? And then how did you experience those lessons for yourself, like in the world, going through your own life?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's such a great question. So I should say first that my name itself is very much a kind of reflection of their journey as immigrants. My name Hajar means somebody who has traveled a long way from their homeland. And my mother was actually pregnant with me when they left Iran. And so they left Iran in the dead of night, you know, over the mountains on horseback. They went through Turkey, ended up in Germany, which is where I was ultimately born. And they ended up in the United States as political refugees. And I actually just recently saw a photocopy of my visa where, you know, it also said on there for me with my little baby picture, refugee. And it really drove home for me how much I took for granted that kind of experience of having grown up here without necessarily thinking deeply about what it meant for my parents, especially thinking about my mom being 26 years old and pregnant for the first time and leaving her family, knowing that she may never see them again. You know, so that piece is really deep for me. And I kind of give you that background to jump into the question with, I think, like a little bit more of a sense of gravitas. You know, like we all have these lessons we learn from our parents. I think some are more impactful than others. But I always tell my students that, you know, even the way we were raised is always rooted in this larger socio-historical context, which is just a kind of fancy way of talking about the fact that all of us are shaped by these larger political systems, even if we literally want to have nothing to do with it, right? So we don't really have a choice. It is just ascribed to us. So for my parents being really politically active when they were in Iran, they just embedded in me such a critical imagination, literally asking me to ask questions about everything, like question authority, not to their face, like let's not get in trouble, but just question what it means. Like, why is that person in power? What does it mean for them to instruct you to do X, Y, Z? And honestly, it was annoying. Like, it was so annoying as a child to, you know, want to have a conversation and be like, ugh, like, that's just so weird. And they'd be like, well, why is it weird compared to what? You know, and I'd be like, well, you know, like, it's just not normal. And they'd be like, well, what's normal? And it was so infuriating because, you know, you're just trying to tell some story about some strange, bizarre thing that happened at, you know, in lunch or something. But ultimately, I do think it really pushed me because it made me realize just how much the world around us is socially constructed. So honestly, it is not surprising that I ended up becoming a sociologist considering how I was raised. But I think a lot of their commitment to having me and my sister ask questions was because they really believed that education and enlightenment were liberation. And so they really wanted to make sure we never let anyone underestimate us. You know, at school, it was really easy for teachers to overlook us. We were some of the only brown kids, especially when I was a lot younger, growing up in a very white community. And they didn't want other people to decide for us what our life chances were going to be, who we were going to become. And I think now when I'm thinking so much about like, why am I constantly hustling? You know, why am I trying to do new things? Haven't I done enough? I always come back to that where I think a lot of it is about proving something, not to other people, but really to myself. Just sort of the idea that we can actually do things that we never could have imagined. And I think the last thing I'd say is for them, you know, they were atheists and they were raised Muslim, but, you know, through their political learning and then becoming very politically active, their political consciousness, they really believed in a world that was driven by a faith in humanity as opposed to any particular religion. And that has shaped me so powerfully because I think it's easy to root, you know, a moral mindset, a sense of your values in a proper religious framework. I think it can be a beautiful sense of community. I've actually seen a lot of value in religion, but growing up without it, you have to find something else. And I think the one thing that drives me and keeps me going is that faith in humanity and knowing that there's always something bigger than me as an individual, that everything I do actually matters beyond me.
Wow. That was really good. I expect nothing less. Like all the stuff that I researched and I saw about you, this, like, there was nothing that was, I would say, like, surface level. Everything had like these deeper questions and all of this other stuff that you have to start kind of turning and asking yourself. So you're like, oh man, gosh, maybe I should just stop the research. I love to learn these things because these are the conversations that I always hope to have. And so from one teacher to another, right? Always asking these kids, because I do the same thing that your parents did with you. I'm always asking the same thing to my teenagers.
I love that.
And then so they say like, okay, well, that is, you brought up the word weird. That's one for me because like, what is weird? It depends on the context in which we're in, because weird to some culture or some person may be normal to another. And so then you go, well, again, what is normal? So
exactly.
These questions, they really make people think about their motivations, why they think the way that they do. And then kind of, like you said, going back to, okay, now where does those come from? You know, like how my parents were raised by my grandparents now affect the way that they taught me, you know, two generations later. So there's always like these bigger questions that you can ask.
Yes.
You just want to go, I'm tired of asking these questions.
Can you turn it off at all? Okay. So, I mean, you were probably going to ask me about some of this crazy stuff later, but I'm just going to divulge now that for me,
sure,
you know, I study these deeply depressing subjects when it comes to social inequality and racism and xenophobia and systems of power and all of this. But one of my guilty pleasures is just bad reality TV. Like I really like all of the Bravo Real Housewives franchises, for example. And my husband is constantly like just completely disgusted. Like he's like, how can you possibly, especially like knowing what you study about like race and power, right? And I get that. And at the same time, I think for me, it's a reprieve because I'm like, but it's so stupid. And it brings me a little bit of joy. So I'm like, wherever you need to find it, I think there's a little bit of value in it. But I mean, even beyond that, I think I do get tired of asking questions, but it's so built in. I don't know if you feel the same way, where it's so built in. It's actually kind of impossible to turn off. I mean, I even went, I took the kids to see the Barbie movie like a week or two ago, and I could not help myself. I was like, that just, you know, it didn't do what it thought it was doing. And like, and I was going off afterward, and they're 7 and 4. Like they were like, okay, mommy, but it was so funny. And I'm like, all right, like this is not a conversation I should be having with you guys. You're not following. So, I mean, that's its own thing. But I do think there's some importance in just the practice of questioning. It doesn't have to be negative, right? It could literally just be interrogating our own assumptions about XYZ, because I actually think there is a lot of even self-liberation in that, thinking about like, oh, why did I think I looked fat when I wore that dress? Or like, why is it that I think I can't do so-and-so or whatever? So I think even just asking those questions can get to these rooted questions that maybe because of the way we're socialized and raised, and maybe because of what the world has been telling us, you know, the representations we've seen in the media, just things we've internalized and not even questioned. So there is a lot of power in those questions, even when they get to be quite exhausting.
So you talked about growing up and kind of getting tired of your parents asking those questions. When did you start to maybe like embrace that side of yourself and start to now, when did the light go on, the switch go on for you? So now you're always asking these questions and you're kind of enjoying it and digging deeper and starting to find these different answers. And sometimes the questions lead to more questions. When did that start to happen for you?
Yeah, I think there wasn't one particular defining moment, but I do think there was something to the fact that I experienced 9/11 in the second week of my very first year of undergrad at the University of Virginia. And so the experience of this large-scale homogenization of brown people, where before 9/11, it's not like I'd never experienced discrimination. I experienced it in all sorts of microaggression-y ways all the time. But it was much more of a kind of like, oh, that's a funny name. And the sort of questions like, where are you really from? The questions that immigrants and children of immigrants get all the time. But after 9/11, there was a sense of disdain. There was a sense of hostility when it came to my name, where immediately it was like, oh, you're one of them. And, you know, I graduated in 2005 and moved to New York City. And even the fact that in job interviews, there was always kind of that background tenor of like, I'm just trying to place you. And then it ended up being quite difficult to find a quote unquote good job. I ended up actually getting a job off Craigslist working for a jewelry designer, even though I was, you know, an English major really interested in the nonprofit world. But I think that was the space in college where the sort of intersection of this huge political moment that shifted our political and cultural context just irrevocably, you know, in ways that we would never return from. And then at the same time, also taking these classes that gave me lenses for understanding it. I mean, I credit so much of my awakening to just the legacies of Black thought, because it was reading Du Bois and Baldwin and Audre Lorde. I mean, just some of the big greats that really think about power and how it shapes the way you see yourself, that sense of double consciousness where you're constantly reconciling who you think you are with who other people think you are. I mean, the way that resonated, it gave me chills. And every time I read Du Bois, I'm like, yes. I mean, and that is the experience of Black Americans, right? But even that idea of the veil just speaks to the way that racial systems work. So I think that was a moment where I was like, oh, like my parents aren't crazy, you know, and like some of the things they said actually make more sense now. Not like I really had poo-pooed them quite so much as I just kind of wanted to live in La La Land and, you know, try to be like the token, you know, brown person in my white friend group. But they made me think about all of that differently. Like, why was I chasing, you know, that proximity to whiteness? And that like led to a good decade plus, it's still ongoing, of excavation, of really thinking about my own identity and where I position myself and why I have a tendency to try to make myself small and quiet and please other people. All of these things come to the surface.
That makes me think of like one of those sayings, like, you got to work twice as hard, you know, because of, you know, this girl, the color of your skin, like you have to be wary of the way that you carry yourself and, you know, try not to come off too aggressive, you know, as a Black man in America, you know, all of these things that you're taught is like you can be taught those things and they can tell you, but until you experience it, right, until you go through that racial inequality and, you know, you being a brown woman, so like it's double, you just start to go, oh, got it. And then the fact is, then you have to teach those same kind of lessons to your kids, right? Because like you said, we can't live in la la land. We have to like, okay, this is how we want things to be. And maybe we're getting there a little bit, but we also have to live in reality and, you know, try to be prepared for as much as we can. So you talked about your time in Virginia, but you also spent time in Chapel Hill getting your master's, I believe.
PhD,
or
yes.
Your PhD at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You spent time in New York, and you're also an associate professor at USC.
Assistant, but I love that you gave assistant. Me tenure. Thank you for giving me tenure.
Yes, we're speaking that. We're moving forward. You've spent your time all around the country in these different areas, vastly different areas, right? And I'm always interested to see what your thoughts and experience are around that, because as a son of divorced parents, I lived in Detroit, and then we spent time in Connecticut. I live in Houston now. I spent time in China teaching English as a, you know, as an expat, you know, teaching abroad. So I've lived in these different places, and you kind of experience them in different ways. And inevitably you compare them like, oh, this is different here. This is different here. They do this better over here. They do this better over there. So I give all the context to how do you, I guess, perceive and lived in these different places, and who were you as you lived there?
Oh my God. I love like a sort of life journey, place-based question. So I think you kind of nailed it, because I do think that shapes people in such deep ways. I don't know that folks always recognize how much the place that they live in matters, right? I mean, so I think for me, there was coming of age in Northern Virginia, which I always emphasize Northern Virginia because that's what we do, right? We always try to distinguish ourselves from the South. Like, we're not the racist folks.
West side of Detroit.
Yes, right? But it's so clear to me now. I'm like, just because it was Northern Virginia doesn't mean it was really all that different. We were close to the Pentagon. You know, we had a lot of like military folks, a highly conservative that lived in the area. And that's cool. But it did shape, you know, the limits of how much I could say. I think about even just being in elementary school and the fact that we would learn like military songs, you know, in our music class. Like, that's what we did. I'm like, why do I know that song? And I'm like, oh, okay, because that's what we would sing in first grade. But I say that because it's been so different now living in Los Angeles. I actually think there was a lot of congruity between Northern Virginia, you know, going to school in Charlottesville, Virginia for undergrad, and then PhD program in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Like, all of that sort of had a similar feel to it. I think New York for me was the first time I felt a little bit free, because I was sort of racially, ethnically ambiguous. It's a highly diverse city in terms of racial and ethnic composition, not so much in terms of class anymore, but at least when I first moved there in 05, you know, I was living in like a tiny 3-bedroom that was actually a converted 1-bedroom on St. Mark's Place, you know, right in Manhattan, the East Village, which now would be impossible, you know. So like I could rent that for $900 a month. And now that's completely impossible.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy to think. Because for me, I'm like, oh, it wasn't that long ago. But I guess it was, in terms of, you know, gentrification and just demographic change.
Almost 20 years ago.
I know. Isn't that crazy? Why'd you have to remind me? Okay, so you did the math for me. It is. Yeah, it's a numbers podcast. I get it. So, you know, then I compare that to living in Los Angeles now, where there are tons of Iranian people. They live on the West Side. They tend to be a lot richer than I am. And so, you know, I'm not part of the community, but it's not unique the way that I feel like it was more when I was growing up, for me to be like, oh, yeah, I'm Iranian American. People are always like, oh, yeah, I have a ton of Iranian friends. And like, just people speak Farsi to me. And I'm like, oh, you know more than I do. So I think that question always comes up. Also thinking about raising children, like you were saying, I have young kids, like I said, 7 and 4. And they're also, you know, I'm married a white man. So they are light skinned. That people always say they kind of look like Persian versions of my husband. So, you know, like a little bit browner, but not quite as brown as me. And certainly blend in with a very Latino population here where I live in Pasadena. Nobody questions who they are in ways that are so different from the way I was raised. But this is the big thing for me, is the racism in the South was so honest. It was a lot more in your face, and it was very clear. There is a difference between that and the way folks in La La Land over here truly believe that they are enlightened. It's a lot of kind of white progressivism, which actually in a lot, it's been more difficult to crack that egg and be like, no, no, we still have work to do. We still need to confront the fact that this school, for example, is very white, or the fact that a lot of white folk are moving into this neighborhood and pushing the brown and black people out, like including us, right? I'm going to, you know, raise my hand as well. We're some of these gentrifiers, whether we want to be or not, we have to reckon with that. So that for me has been the interesting piece where my recognition of the power of place has evolved with my own sort of learning and thinking about my own place in white supremacy, which is really uncomfortable. Nobody ever wants to be like, oh, I'm complicit too. But I think there's freedom in that, because if you just think you live outside of it, if you think that just by kind of denying that it matters, or even by saying, well, I'm not personally racist, so we're good, then I think you miss an opportunity, right? And I think a lot of really well-meaning people are in that space where they think, well, I have black friends, or like, you know,
that's the one.
That's the big one. Yeah. Like my best friend is black. And I'm like, yeah, but that's, you know, you have to do the deeper work. And it's so uncomfortable. I tell my students this all the time, because I think a lot of them come in having been raised in Southern California. They feel like they get it. Like they're very progressive. They vote blue. They're anti-Trump. They know all the language of inclusivity, but they haven't done the work to excavate the sort of internalized white supremacy, the way that they operate in the world, and then the intersectional piece where, yeah, you know, you may actually have a very diverse group of friends, but like, can we talk about your family's income levels and your wealth levels and, you know, the neighborhoods where you grew up? All these questions, all of them come into play.
So how could somebody, they go, okay, Dr. Hajar, I am willing to do the work. What must I do? What would you tell that person?
Oh, Lord. Yeah, it's like, you know, if it was like one thing, it would be so great. I wish I could just tell you one thing. So I think the first piece is a willingness to do the messy work is actually a huge step. And I think there has to be recognition that it's not just, you know, reading one book, although please do buy my book. You know, doing the training, although again, an anti-racism training, a proper one. I did one through the People's Institute, for example, and it was transformative. It has to be ongoing. You have to continue to reflect, ask yourself the tough questions, think about your own space, even within your personal networks. Think about who you put yourself in proximity to, whose voices you amplify, what you take in, what kind of information. And also, one of the things I talk about a lot when I think about my book is the importance of coming to get your own people. So I think it's super important to support Black community organizations, to amplify the work of Black thought leaders and activists. And in addition to that, I think it's really important to have the difficult conversations with your own people. So in my case, that's non-white immigrants. And like for my husband, it's talking to white family members, talking to, you know, his evangelical family members in the South. And it is messy. You have to be willing to accept that you're not going to change people's minds. But even that process of doing the hard work is worth it. It does matter in the long run.
So this is probably a little personal, but what has one of those conversations looked like, you know, talking to, because I've been married, it'll be 10 years in 2 days. But my wife's black, so the questions are different, right? The deeper excavation work for us is different because we're both black. But you doing that work with a white family is, I'm sure, bananas, for the lack of a better word. So if you could, if there's like just any like small piece like that you could let the listeners in on, like, what is something that y'all had to talk about that was like, uh-oh, they have no idea about how crazy this can be.
Yeah. Oh my God. It can be so crazy. Cause I mean, I also think it's funny to have your own personal evolution while you are evolving in a relationship with the person that you marry or choose to spend your life with. So I can think about even the first time that I had done some of this work, right? I'd started like really digging into the messy stuff. And I did the proper anti-racism training. And I came home with like a whole new toolkit and a set of language. And I was talking to him about white privilege. And it was such a textbook white person reaction where he got defensive and personally offended. And he was like, but I mean, I couldn't even tell you what he said because all I really remember is that he was just sort of upset. You know, like his reaction mm-hmm. was to just make it about him.
How dare you?
But me? And it's funny too, because if you know my husband, he's like literally the definition of privilege. He is like a 6'6" large white man. So, and we always talk about how cops will like do the head nod to him because they think he's a cop. So it's like just kind of above and beyond the level of privilege. But he sat with it because he's him. He's a listener. Not everybody is. He sat with it. And then he had a willingness to keep listening. And I also had recognized the limits. Like I had recognized through the training, which again, there's not sort of like one silver bullet for this stuff. But the training was effective because it did tell me that the conversations that I had with other people were not going to be sort of easy with happy endings. So in sitting with it, I think he realized he needed to know more. And that's where we got to talk more about what that larger system looked like, the fact that it wasn't about him personally or attacking him, and then him recognizing more and more that, oh, this is actually a very different experience when I'm with you and certain things happen as opposed to when you're going to go do something by yourself. And he started to recognize things like the cops nodding at him or white folks saying really racist things to him because they thought he would agree with them. And then kind of remembering all sorts of other experiences he'd had where he was like, oh, like they actually thought I thought that too. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like obviously.
That's how it works.
Yeah. But you know, it's for me, it feels like night and day now from that moment to now. But he recognizes too that it's still ongoing. You know, it's like it never actually ends. And you can't just take all of your power and give it away. I do think the most effective mm-hmm. thing for him has been realizing that it's not just about saying like, oh, I support anti-racism or, you know, during the pandemic, he put on his mask and went to the Black Lives Matter protest. It's not about that. It's about actually having the really uncomfortable conversations with his own family when they say things that don't make sense. Like calling out a family member when they come to me to ask me about, you know, why those Saudi Arabian women are so oppressed. Yes. And you know what? Like facepalm, but also that is a question we get, right? In all sorts of forms. Like we're always supposed to represent a literal mm-hmm. like cluster of countries and cultures and places we've literally never been to. I remember one of his family friends asking me about why Huma Abedin would stay with Anthony Weiner after like the affair. Like he was like, but Muslim women are just very submissive, right? And I was like, first of all, yeah, I mean, it was, but you know what? We have these stories. And I think it's so easy to like shake our heads and laugh at them. But I also think there's such opportunities to think about why folks, again, that question of why folks carry those assumptions, why they think they can talk to us a particular way, you know, what levels of disrespect are embedded in that that keep us in our place. I love this idea that the scholar Corey Mitchell has of, she calls it know your place microaggressions. And I think that's exactly right, because that's what it feels like when these microaggressions come at you. It feels like people are keeping you in your place. They're reminding you of where you stand. So anyway, that's like a very long-winded way of saying that I don't have a good answer for, you know, talking to our white people. But I do think the big thing is getting our white people to understand they need to talk to their white people. Like that is not our job.
It reminds me, two things came to mind as you were talking. So my wife, who grew up in, I guess it was a predominantly white school. And every time like Black History Month would come around, like everybody's looking at her for all the answers. Like, okay, Black person, like, how does this make you feel? It's like, all right, here we go.
Yes.
And she just talked about how uncomfortable that was, especially like as a teenager. And if you're not really locked into that kind of stuff, you don't know any more than they do, right? You just read the books and watch the stories and stuff that they bring up in school, just like everybody else, you know, unless you have like some hardcore pro-black parent or somebody that's really like giving you the game in that way. And the other thing that I thought about, and I've watched the, well, I've seen tons of videos on this stuff, and it talks about culture vultures, where, and specifically in the rap community, where you have white rappers, they come in and they talk about like how they steal from the culture just for their own good, just to make themselves a lot of times something that they're not. And a lot of times people will praise a guy like Eminem because he was always giving back to the culture and bringing other guys along. Like they went and got 50 Cent, who was one of the biggest rappers, you know, ever, especially for his time. He burned like white hot, like he was the thing. But, and you hear him talk about it, he's like, I'm always talking about respect the craft, respect the craft. You know, it's all about rap. I care way more about the people, the originators, right? Which is black people. I care more about them knowing that I'm good and that I'm like the real deal and I'm not just coming stealing from the culture, you know? And so when you were talking about that, that's one of the things that came to mind where it's like, I'm sure at some point, maybe directly or indirectly, he had these same kind of questions for himself. Cause at that point, it's kind of like a reverse minority kind of thing. Like, do yes. I belong here? People make these assumptions. So it's funny how these parallels can happen in these different contexts of life.
100%. Wow,
so many questions.
Yes.
So many questions. So as you do all of this research, which I'll jump to our next number here. So the income gap between white and black households is $33,000. I think that study was done in 2018, which brings us to your research about power and the unequal distribution of choices and agency. Man, again, every time I read something, I'm like, oh my goodness, I have to read that two or three more times. So how have you seen that in action, like in the lives of everyday people? Because that's a lot of what your research is. You know, we'll talk about your book here in a second. But how do you see that on a day-to-day basis? And what are some other things that you've done in your research to try to shift the tides?
Yeah. So I think so much of it has been this process of learning more and self-reflecting has made me look back at the experiences I've had growing up in different educational systems, and then even in the workplace. And I think it's been most glaring for me when I think about the hand I've had in hiring decisions. Like when you're finally on the other side and you hear the conversations that take place in the room within closed doors, you realize how deeply unequally distributed resources are. And for me, one of the most powerful things is the unequal distribution of the benefit of the doubt. So the way that a gap on a resume, the way that in my case, like in my sort of academic field, a lack of publications in the best outlets or a lack of number of publications, a question about where somebody got their PhD, all of these things that are used in the service of making quote unquote objective decisions about the best person to hire, all of these things are rooted in a system that ascribes us with different levels of credibility, of different levels of legitimacy. And there's a sociologist named Lauren Rivera who did this great study where she identified what she calls the cultural fit argument, which is basically that that's how you make these decisions about who ends up in the room is do they fit the culture of our organization, of our workplace, of our school? And they end up unsurprisingly being very raced and classed. So if you decide that the cultural fit of your organization requires talking a certain way, playing golf on weekends, you know, wearing polo shirts, et cetera, et cetera. You can think about all sorts of different, you know, external markers that would signal that you fit with a certain organization. Well, then it'll be really easy to make a case that like, you know, the black guy that plays basketball in the evenings doesn't fit, or, you know, the brown girl who doesn't talk like a white girl isn't really going to get along with the other folks in this organization. It's really easy to code it. And then they don't end up in those spaces. But I think the other thing that's been really hard is in the wake of the George Floyd murder and the rise of all of these DEI initiatives, like everybody was reading White Fragility and everybody was reading Ibram X. Kendi's book. And unfortunately, a lot of times it meant, yes, thank God, finally we're hiring more Black and Brown people. But then we're not actually supporting them within our organizations. And so, and then it makes it really easy to say, like, well, it didn't work out. We tried, but, you know, they weren't a fit. Mm-hmm. Or, well, unfortunately, they just couldn't, you know, create the output that we needed. Well, yeah, because you didn't actually put the infrastructure in place to support them the way that you do implicitly for folks that you deem a good fit, who feel like you.
Part of the culture.
Exactly. Part of the culture. So that's the way I've witnessed it sort of on the day to day. And I think, you know, it's like I was saying, the anti-Blackness is so deeply embedded that it's difficult. And honestly, it can be really depressing to even think about how hard it is to eradicate when it's built into every single system from the get-go. But one of the things that I talk about in the book is, especially thinking about, you know, in the book, I should just say, I write about the co-optation of Dr. King's memory and how it's been used in the service of all of these anti-democratic, anti-civil rights projects, everything from repealing the Voting Rights Act to repealing affirmative action. And in all these instances, they use Dr. King's words out of context to claim that he would have supported, you know, banning books. He would have supported banning racial education. So the big thing there is this is all building this culture of ignorance, is what I'm describing. And I think once you understand how that culture of ignorance is built, it just completely obscures these systems of inequality. So it's really hard to understand why they exist. And it's so easy to explain them away as just a matter of individual failings. Well, that person just didn't work hard enough. You know, they didn't really put the time in. And that's exactly how power reproduces itself. It makes it impossible for you to understand. So you just have to be complicit and kind of blame yourself for anything that goes wrong in your life.
So when these things happen to people, right? And just as an aside, everywhere that I go, I'm always looking for Black people that work there. I don't know if you do the same thing. You're shaking your head. My guess is yes. Yeah. I'm like, okay. And I would have to ask myself the deeper question if there's anything that's, you know, but I'm like, I guess the question is like, are we getting a chance here at this place? Whatever the place is, like it could be McDonald's or it could be a hospital, like, because of the systems, I'm like, are we getting a shot? And are we getting like the good jobs? So very quick, short story. I went to the doctor and just had like I wasn't like sick, but it was something. So I'm like, all right, let me just go get this checked out. See what's up. So the person that came and got me, or actually I came in and I saw a bunch of Black people. I saw a bunch of us. I'm like, okay. And this is like an urgent care in a nicer place, nicer city, Sugar Land for the people that's listening in Houston. And so I go, okay, all right, we here. And these are all the conversations that we have in our heads. So I'm sitting there, somebody come and get me. I'm like, okay, yep. Hello, how you doing? And so I'm talking to the lady and I say, it's a lot of Black people that work here. And she just starts laughing and she's like, yeah. I said, okay, that's cool. I'm just noticing, just an observation. And so she says, she does her thing. And she's like, okay, Tanya will be with you soon. I said, Tanya? She already knew where I was going. I said, she Black? She said, yes. I said, I just gave a little fist bump. The lady started laughing. And it's just something that is ingrained in us because of the world that we live in, like all the stuff that we've been through. We like, man, to see us get the shot in a place like this, I'm good.
Yes.
You know, so just as an aside, you know.
No, but you know what? I think it's so important because it's not even just the sense of like comfort. You know, there are actual life and death stakes to this. So especially when you think about healthcare, like it matters that you have somebody who's Black because they are more likely to listen to you and to believe you. And to give you the type of care and prescriptions that you need. And so, you know, even when you think about like the Black maternal health crisis, it's devastating to think how many of these women could be alive if they had had, you know, the Black nurse, the Black doctor to listen to them.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, it's like that question of the spaces where it matters, because I think policing is one case where it's shown that it doesn't matter. because the system is so broken that having Black police officers is not going to mean that Black people don't get killed by police. So yeah, I mean, I think that complexity is its own story. Like, that's its own difficult thing to figure out.
So where are some of the wins? Because you talked about how difficult what you study is. Where have you seen like some W's where you go, ah, yes, finally somebody gets it and something is happening in a good way that's helpful for, you know, minorities and everybody? Because as white people in this context, they're learning and things are changing. It's a win for them too. So what are some places where you've seen that headway has been made?
Yeah, I mean, I think internally in sociology, I've been so excited to see folks who are completely shifting and remaking the boundaries of what we think is possible as academics. So one really big example, because she's such a hero and I just stan her so much, is Dr. Tressie McMillan Cottom, who has, you know, she has a column in the New York Times. She writes for Vanity Fair. She did like this amazing story about P. Diddy where she just goes deep. Like everything that is about culture and power, she goes so deep and she takes it to new spaces. She is just the epitome of public sociology and of taking the work that we so often just limit to ourselves and we just talk to ourselves at our little conferences and write our papers for each other in our books. She has shown me that we could actually do good with our work and reach really wide audiences. So that for me is just a general collective win for sociology and I think for academia and just sort of the world of the possibilities of scholarship for creating a better world. I think for me individually, just looking at my students is the biggest win. Seeing my students thrive, seeing them create their own pathways to dreams that I never could have even imagined. I think finding your people can be so powerful and they're showing me that, you know, I came up in a time where I really thought you did have to make yourself small and sort of fit the mold in order to get where you wanted to be. I always thought, okay, I'll play the game until I get into a position of power and then I can really do me and try to change things from the inside. Even though I've always really believed in the Audre Lorde quote, you know, about how, you know, you can't break down the master. What is it? Break down the master's house with master's tools. All right. It's not coming to me right now. It's late in the day for me. But you know the quote, right? Like, and I think for me, that's the most powerful idea is that you can do things differently and just remain rooted, you know, in your own values, your own sense of self. I've seen my students do it. And part of it's a generational thing too. I think Gen Z is coming up with, for one thing, a complete and utter frustration and exhaustion with the way things have been done. I think coming out of the pandemic, a lot of my students are like, this isn't working. We cannot keep doing things the way that we've always done them. And they really believe we can build the world anew. And so just that kind of inspiration and imagination is really the big win.
So I have a cousin. He's 38. He's 4 years older than I am. And he asked me the last time we talked. And he's like, man, do we have any hope for the future? Like, I see some of these kids. I see what's on social media. You're in the high schools, like, please tell me there's hope. I'm like, I say, Derek, trust me, we're going to be good. Like, there are tons of brilliant minds out here. Like, you won't believe how smart a lot of these kids are, way past like what we were doing. They just have access to so much information. So when you talk about your kids, you know, being like these free thinkers and pushing for change, you know, I see it. You know, I guess before you do it on a high school level. So as they get to you, they're still coming up with these ideas. They're still like really pushing for it before life rips it out of them. You know, so, you know, I'm always doing the same thing. I'm pushing like, hey, you know, you can do what you want to do. Come up with those ideas. Go for it. And so, like, speaking of not making yourself small, you have a wonderful picture behind you of your book. And that's going to bring us to our last number. And it's from one of your favorite people. And I'm sure you will know this quote when I say it because it has the number in. And it says, and one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you are raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. Who said that?
Could it be Dr. King?
You are correct. So, your book, The Struggle for the People's King, I'll just open it up to you. What were your motivations? How did you actually narrow it down to like writing about this thing specifically? And the floor is yours.
So I have always cared about these big questions about belonging and our futures. Clearly. And how we see ourselves, right? How do we come into community? Like, how do we find spaces where we feel like we belong? And then how do we expand them to make them more inclusive? But specifically, I was in graduate school and I was studying race and social movements and thinking about, you know, what sort of dissertation project I was going to do. And at the same time, there is this story playing out in the news, and it is this mediocre white girl named Abigail Fisher. And she is going to the Supreme Court to challenge affirmative action because she says she did not get into UT Austin because of affirmative action. Now, I'm going to emphasize that all of us came to find out that she was actually a very mediocre student. So we could just start with that. But for, excuse me, for me, what was most crazy about the whole situation is that they were using the words of Dr. King, of colorblindness, of individualism to take on affirmative action as a form of reverse racism against white people. And that just shook me to my core. I was like, are we actually going to say in the highest court in the land and take this seriously that white people are being discriminated against because of affirmative action and then use Dr. King to legitimize it? So I had to dig deeper. So for me, it started there where I was looking at all of these cases that fell under this rubric of what they call colorblind constitutionalism. It's this idea that the law ought to be race neutral. And it sounds really great in theory, but as we know, it's actually been used in the service of completely obscuring inequality and why it exists, obscuring the fact that the white privilege and system of power that benefits white people is actually baked into the law. And as I'm looking at these cases, I'm noticing in every single instance, it's Dr. King's words that are coming up over and over again, being co-opted and misappropriated and used in all of these crazy ways by these right-wing groups. And so I was like, okay, this is the story. And of course, I was not the first one to point this out because when I was doing the research, it was clear to me that historians had been calling this out for years, activists had been calling out civil rights leaders, Dr. King's own children. Every time his words were co-opted, there was this groundswell of folks calling it out. And Black communities were like, that is not actually the history. That is not what Dr. King meant. And yet, the mainstream story that I was seeing play out in the news, the story that was becoming the sort of general collective memory that we all learn in our textbooks and see in the movies, was the story of Dr. King as an end chapter where racism ended in the past and where he would have believed in a colorblind nation where we never talked about race. Which for you and me sounds absolutely wild, but for the average American sounds about right. So that's the story that I lay out. I look at 40 years of the uses and the misuses of Dr. King in my book, and I really think about why they matter, the consequences that they have. And I think that's been the hardest part, is recognizing just how it's built this culture of ignorance that makes it impossible to take racial inequality on, because we're living on two completely different planes, one that is rooted in actual history and social reality, and another alt history that has created the perception that white people are under threat and that they need to take their country back. Yes, I'm with you. I am also holding my head in my hands and kind of crying inside.
You go, so when this stuff happens, you know, you go, affirmative action gets reversed, Roe v. Wade gets reversed. In my mind, and I've done nowhere near the kind of research that you have done, I'm like, how do these things get reversed after so many years of people feeling like these things have needed to be in place and the things that they've done, just for the people who have no idea how these things happen? Can you explain how do they reverse these decisions that have been in place and have helped so many people for this long?
Yeah, I think the disturbing part is that they have played a very clever long game. So I show my book. It was really easy to blame the present state of affairs on Donald Trump, for example. Or if you have a longer sense of history, a lot of folks will blame it on the reactionary politics that came out of Obama's presidency. And it's true, both things have definitely exacerbated this longer pattern. But if you look at it, this has been happening ever since the gains of the civil rights movement. There has been the significant white lash, what the historian Carol Anderson calls, you know, white backlash, called white lash. And it is this reaction to multicultural democracy as a threat to white Americans, a threat to their status, to their power, to their hold on American history. And because they have worked so incrementally over time to just distort history and create this revisionist history where, again, you know, King is the end of racism. So now, if there's racial inequality, it's because you didn't do the work. You didn't work hard enough. It's because your culture is lazy. You know, it's because your culture is too violent. And this is what we call cultural racism, because it's just another form of racism that, you know, is coded in all sorts of language about culture and right. individual values, families. And so when you play that long game, what's really clever is that it all takes place under your nose, because the general public, and I'll be very clear, I mean the non-Black public, because I think Black folks are very aware of all of this and have been aware of this. The non-Black public has been sleepwalking because there have been these, you know, sort of rosy stories that have been held up, like Obama's presidency was known as the signal of the post-racial era. And he himself, right, perpetuated a lot of this colorblind language and, you know, sort of perpetuating the idea that we had come a long way, that racial progress was very linear, we were going up from here. And I understand, especially for a president or any kind of politician, the impetus, like the inclination to have that sort of optimism and want to speak very kindly about your country, especially for a Black president, the stakes were going to be really high. We saw the times, even after Trayvon Martin's murder, where he was held to task simply for saying that Trayvon could have been his son, even just acknowledging that he was also Black. People were so upset and they called it, you know, anti-white, called him a racist. So I understand that the stakes were high, but I think a big part of it is that the right has just very effectively moved politics to the right, where now you look at the Democratic Party and their politics look like the Republican Party of the early 2000s. So, you know, I think that incrementalism, the playing the long game, and then also understanding how power works, not just at that top level of the presidency, but also at the local, the school boards, right? The city councils, all of the, you know, the judges, like every single level, understanding that that is how you build the power. And that's, I think, the most devastating part, because grassroots politics has always been the domain of the left. Like that is rooted in Black history, grassroots politics, the power of the people from below. But when you fund it from the top and you make it look like it's the will of the people, that is super clever.
Oh, man. This is all such unfortunate stuff.
Yeah.
So you've talked about the difficult part of writing a book and going back and seeing Dr. King's words misappropriated. Let's shift gears. I guess, what was the funnest part of writing the book? What is something you look back and you go, man, that was pretty cool?
I love the conclusion. It's so funny because I have friends who just like, you know, they like don't read books anymore. It's fine. Good for them. But they're like, you know, I don't think I'm going to read your book, but I bought it. And I'm like, just read the introduction and the conclusion. And I think you will get the gist and the power of what I'm trying to do. Because for me, the introduction lays out, it sort of drops us right into the co-optation of King. And then the conclusion for me is the fun part because it takes us into the resistance. So I talk about the hashtag Reclaim King movement that emerges out of Black Lives Matter. And it's this movement that gets back to King's radical legacy that's been completely erased and sanitized and whitewashed. That quote that you talked about, the fact that King wasn't just against racism, he was also against, you know, the evils of capitalism, the evils of imperialism and militarism, and that he was trying to do things about it in that last year of his life. Mm-hmm. That the Poor People's Campaign, you know, was going to be the big multiracial, multi-class effort to create a movement from below that was for everybody. And it's been picked up again. So Reverend Barber and Liz Theo Harris, are resurrecting the Poor People's Campaign. And there are all sorts of different efforts. I love the Zen Ed Project, for example, which is, if you follow them on Instagram, every single day they will bring up a history that's been sanitized or forgotten. They are keeping history alive and reminding us that we will not know where we are going without understanding the past.
Okay. Wow. There's always like the flip side of like, okay, there's a lot of bad stuff happening, but there are also a lot of people trying to do stuff about it. And so bringing up those different pages and the different initiatives, I think are very, very helpful. So before we get out of here, we are going to get to the last segment, which is the three what's. And I ask these to every guest I have on. So you can answer these however long, however short, wherever you want to go with these, totally up to you. So first, what? This is, what's an opinion that you have that will be considered unpopular? Like the whole show?
Oh no, you're going to give me enemies. Okay, so this is deeply unpopular, at least among the white people around me. And it is that mayo is gross. I do not like mayo. I don't want to be around mayo. And if you hide it in a casserole or in a fancy aioli, I'll eat it and be totally happy with it. So that's, that's a contradiction that I'm very aware of.
Okay. So my wife is totally on board with that. I do not agree. Here we are. Second what? If you could do something now that you've never done, okay, money is no object. You can do whatever you want. What would that be?
Oh, I mean, it sounds boring, but it's something I've wanted to do since I was a kid, which is write fiction books. So I would get my MFA. I actually hope to do it, like in the next chapter of my life. I hope to have the time to just learn how to write creative fiction and like lay out a narrative structure and all this, because I really think, especially after doing this research, narrative is power. Like if you can frame the story, you can claim it. So I think it's actually a sort of, for me, valuable way to think about social change is doing it through fiction and stories.
I had somebody on that wrote books and she wanted to talk about like, I think it was like young black kids, but she did it like through the story of like Juneteenth and the kid wanted to be an engineer. So like there was all this stuff that was into it, but it was a fictional story, you know? So yeah, there's definitely some roots there that you could definitely tap into. I'm sure you can do it.
I love that.
After we do our last what?
Yes.
What advice would you give to someone in high school? I play this for my kids and I go, hey, like Dr. Hajar. Let's see if I can say your last name. Don't tell me.
Okay.
You can. I haven't said it all episode. Yazdia?
Yes.
All right.
Bravo. Yes. It's phonetic. It's easy.
Okay.
Okay. So wait, so what is the question?
I threw us off track. What would you tell, what advice would you give to kids in high school?
Oh, yes. Okay. So, there's so much advice. And I think part of it is, I will be really honest, I did not have a good high school experience. So if any of you out there are similarly struggling, I see you. And, you know, it sounds so trite, but it really can get better. So I think the big thing is that the obstacles and the tragedies in high school can feel so large. And I know that's such a vulnerable time in your life. You feel powerless in so many ways. And it's one of the first times you're really kind of coming of age and having a sense of self. And you feel like, I know me and you are standing in my way. And it feels devastating. Whatever it is, whether it's like a breakup or getting, you know, denied from some program that feels really important to you, or even something even worse, right? Some violence or loss in your life. So I think when something that terrible happens, it can really feel like, you know, your life is most certainly over, but it is not. You know, those tragedies are beginnings. I believe there are so many of us that are testaments to that. You're going to transform. You're going to grow. You know, it's part of your innate power as a human. I say this as a sociologist who knows on the deepest level that we are social beings. So you're never really alone. and you can always adapt and recreate yourself. I mean, I turned 40 this year and I'm like, we're going to keep doing it. Like, I'm going to keep recreating and reimagining who I'm going to be. So your possible selves are limitless. Don't let anybody define them for you. And I think similarly, I hope that you'll just keep daydreaming. I think there's this point in your life where you start to become an adult and you stop daydreaming. You start being so focused on the day to day. And sometimes the day to day is so bleak and repetitive that it makes you feel like, why are we doing? Like, what is the point of all of this? But don't stop daydreaming, because I really think you can envision so many new worlds when you just allow yourself that space to just think about what could be possible and just allow yourself to be open to it, no matter how wild and seemingly impossible it is.
I love it. Keep daydreaming. Not in class, but, you know.
Okay, not in class.
In your free time. Last but not least, Doctor, tell people where they can find you, where they can get the book, where they can see more of your amazing work.
Yes, please buy the book or ask your library to get it. It is available anywhere books are sold, including Amazon. You know, go to Bookshop if you like indie bookstores. I personally do. You can find me on Instagram at Prof. That's P-R-O-F. Hajar, H-A-J-A-R, Yazdiha, Y-A-Z-D-I-H-A. You can also find me on Twitter, which I will not call its new name. It is always Twitter to me. And I'm at Haj Yazdiha. And also my website, HajarYazdiha.com.
All right. Thank you for coming on the show. And it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Tony. This was a lot of fun.
Boom. We got it.
Yay. Thanks for asking such great questions. That was like definitely one of the harder conversations I've had, but it was good.
Wow. That was an amazing interview. Such a great conversation. I wish me and the great doctor would have been able to talk more, but of course, every conversation has to come to an end. And speaking of endings, you all may have been wondering why the episodes haven't been coming out as frequently as they used to. Well, I've talked about it before. I am in grad school, and I'm actually in the middle of creating another wonderful show. So this episode 100 is going to be the last for now. Living Numbers Podcast will be back. It's not an ending, more like a pause, okay? So once we get to episode 101, it's going to be the start of a new beginning. Of course, I just want to thank all of the people who have supported the show throughout the 100 episodes and the 2.5+ years that the show went on. The Living Numbers Podcast would not have been able to be what it is and what it was without the great people who've always supported me, the wonderful guests that I've had on the show. I mean, I had so much fun interviewing and learning about so many people and meeting these people and just being able to have conversations that were able to enrich the lives of the listeners. So I know if I would start to name names that there would not be enough time. But there is one specific person I got to shout out, and that is my wonderful wife. She's been the person that stayed up with our son and the late nights and the early mornings and all the interviews and all the schedule stuff. Of course, I got to shout her out, and I just want to thank God for giving me the platform to be able to do what I do. And I will say that I will be back. Living Numbers will be back. I am your host, Tony Ramble. See you all next round.